Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya.
Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya.
Namo Vishnu Padaya Krishna Prasthaya Buddhale Srimati Bhaktivedanta Swami Niti Namane. Namaste Saraswata Devi Gauravani Pracharane Nirvishesha Shunyavadi Paschata Desha Tarane Sri Krishna Chaitanya Prabhu Nityananda Sri Advaita Gadadhar Shivasri Gaurabhakta Vrinda Hare Krishna, Hare Krishna, Krishna Krishna, Hare Hare, Hare Rama, Hare Rama, Rama Rama, Hare Hare. Reading from Canto 10, Chapter 49, Verse 20 of Srimad Bhagavatam. Neha,
Neha,
Chachantya,
Chachantya,
Asambhasaha,
Asambhasaha,
Kasyachit,
Kasyachit,
Kenachit,
Kenachit,
Saha,
Rajan
Svenapi
Dehena
Kim U Jaya Majadibi Neha Chakyanta Sambhasaha Kasya Chitkena Chitsaha Rajan Svenapi
Dehena
Kimu jayatma jadibihi
Neha
chatyanta
samvasaha
Kasya chitkena chitsaha Rajan svenapi
dehena
Kimu jayatma jadibihi
In this world,
cha
and
Achanta,
perpetual,
samvasa,
association,
kasyachit,
of
anyone,
kenachit
saha,
with anyone,
rajan,
O
king,
svena,
with one's own,
api,
even,
dehena,
body,
kim u,
what to speak.
Jaya,
with wife,
Hatmaja,
children,
Adibi,
and
so on.
Translation,
in this world
no one has any
permanent relationship
with anyone else.
O king,
we cannot
stay forever,
even
with our own body.
What
to speak
of our wife,
children,
and
the rest.
Text 21.
Every creature
is born
alone and
dies alone,
and anyone
and
alone
one
experiences the
just rewards
of his
good
and
evil deeds.
Purport,
this the
term
anu
bunkte
is significant here.
Bunkte
means
the
living being
experiences,
and anu
means
following
or
in sequence.
In
other words, we
experience happiness
and distress
according to the
moral and spiritual
qualities
of
our activities.
We are
responsible for
what we do.
Dhritarashtra
was falsely
and obsessively
attached
to his evil-minded
sons,
forgetting
that he
alone
would have to
suffer
for his
impudent
behavior.
Translation,
in this world
no one has
any permanent
relationship
with anyone else.
O
king, we cannot
stay
forever even
with our own body.
What to speak
of our wife,
children,
and the rest.
Every
creature is
born alone
and dies
alone,
and
alone
one
experiences
the just
rewards
of his
good
and
evil
deeds.
So this
is
our good
lesson
directed
to Dhritarashtra
specifically,
but actually
good for everyone
in this
material world.
And
of course,
Buddha is
pointing out
that
ultimately
each
jiva
is
responsible
for
his actions.
And
though
other people are
involved
and there are
so many
circumstances
which
we can blame
for our
actions,
nevertheless,
ultimately
we
are responsible
and
we get
karma
as a result
of those
decisions
that we make.
We make
a decision,
and based
on the decision,
other
actions follow.
we may do the action, or somebody else, we may permit somebody else to do an action. This is what a decision is. How do we decide? How do we make a decision? So there's many ways of making a decision. One is we don't think at all. We just whimsically think of anything and say, okay, do it, or I'll do it. That is acting without any intelligence, really. We just do it because, and there's no good reason for doing it. And similar to that, of course, is acting or deciding simply as a reaction to something. We get angry, so we do something. So it's because of an emotion we have, a strong like or a strong dislike. We like that, we want to get it, so we just impulsively we go for it. Or opposite, if we don't like something, we'll maybe attack or something like that. So due to some emotions like fear, envy, angry, greed, lust, etc., we may act without thinking too much. In other words, uncontrolled senses. We can act on that basis also. Both cases, not thinking at all and just doing something, is very, very tamasic. And when we act according to our whims, emotions, that can be tamasic or rajasic. As Krishna says in Bhagavad Gita, you know, when Arjuna asks, why do we act and we do sinful activities as if something is forcing us, even beyond our control, and we don't want to do the act, still we do it. And we commit some sinful act, and our intelligence says don't do it, but yet we do it anyway. So what is the cause of that? And then Krishna says, okay, it's lust, and transform into anger. So there we get the mode of passion and the mode of ignorance acting upon a jiva to push him into different acts in this material world. And of course, the counter, what that implies is that sattva is much better than raja and tama. So, in ignorance, of course, we exhibit anger and so many things, or we don't even think at all because we are afflicted by sleep and indolence and laziness, so we don't want to think. So anything's okay. And then passion, we have all its extreme lusts, etc., desires. So then the alternative is sattva. So what happens in sattva? So the qualification for sattva gun is one has a sense of prakasha and sukha. But that sukha is not what we think it is. That sukha is an internal happiness derived not from external sources. And therefore we control our senses. So we are satisfied in this world with very little. And tapasya or austerity is natural to us. That is the sukha of sattva guna. And prakasha means knowledge. We have a sense of knowledge, which means that we discriminate very carefully in what we do. And ultimately, the highest knowledge, of course, is we distinguish atma from body. And we're not the material body at all. And of course, from that, we get knowledge of scripture and so many things and higher knowledge. So, sattva guna is more favorable for thinking very carefully before we carry out our actions and not simply according to feelings. Because we are detached from everything and we have knowledge and a sense of discrimination. So, of course, the Prabhupada always says that the difference between a human being and an animal is intelligence. And with intelligence, then we have the power of discrimination and thought process before we carry out actions and before we make decisions. We carefully decide what we want to do. So this is the good quality of the human being which distinguishes them from animals. You can very, very carefully think of what you should do. So, of course, now we have various reasons or pros and cons we can think of on doing certain things. But even that is faulty. Because all of our reasons may be simply prejudiced in our direction. We may have one perspective only, why we want to get this. In other words, our reasoning is controlled by our desires. and we'll think it will justify all of our actions in terms of our desires. So this, of course, is not very good reasoning. When we talk about reasoning, we mean balanced reasoning, and where we can see both sides of the picture. So that's why knowledge is important. Knowledge means that we see from a higher perspective. And so that is available in sattva-guna, but not in rajagun and tamagun. So comparatively speaking, then sattva-guna is better. So when we fall into different, everyone is not alone, as it says here, and no one is alone in this material world. We're surrounded by so many things, but in a sense, we also are alone. Because even though we're surrounded by many people, we should not put the blame for our actions on other people and think that, oh, they are the cause. Because of this, they did this, therefore I do this. And because they did that, then I did this. Therefore, I'm not responsible for the result, therefore I should not get the karma. So in other words, when we blame all the other people around us in this material world for our actions, then we are shirking our responsibilities. And we think, I don't deserve any karma for this. So this is not proper. We have to very, very carefully understand our actions and decide carefully before we act. And then we don't blame other people for our results. The actions we do and the results we get. So this is what responsibility is. One meaning of responsibility means the ability to respond. So the ability to respond, response means that before the stimulus simply creates a reaction in us, we stop and we consider very carefully. And then we think, I should act like this, or I should do this, this, because of this, 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 this. And then we decide. So that is responsibility. And when we don't do that, it is simply a reaction. Someone attacks, I attack back. Somebody argues, I argue back. This sort of thing. That's no discrimination at all. So all of this, if we have that discrimination power, then and we carefully consider what to do first, and then we act, then usually those actions will be of a higher, much higher quality, and we will not be subject to severe karmic reactions. So what this means is when we act as a reaction to the surroundings and people around us, then without thought, then we create karmas of suffering. Because generally when we act in that mode, we simply attack others and take from others aggressively. So in that sense, we create sinful activity. Sinful activity means suffering. And if we act in sattva, with careful consideration of what is proper and right according to scripture and according to our good judgment, then such violence is minimized. Sin is minimized. And then I don't have to suffer karmas like that. I still get karma in one sense because my actions, as long as I do actions in the material world, I must get reactions. So the reaction there is punya. I do good actions, I get good results, so therefore next lifetime I don't have to suffer. I get some nice results, material comforts out of this. So some karma is there, but it's not the suffering aspect. So most people won't reject that. They want to reject the suffering part, then no one will reject the happiness part. If you get money for free, no one's going to reject that. But if everything gets taken away from us, then we complain. And we suffer. So, if we're in sattva-guna, then we minimize the bad aspects of karma, the suffering aspects of karma, and we maximize the good aspects of it. That we're not free from karma, but at least we don't have to suffer in this material world. So when we act with discrimination very, very nicely in this material world, and we commit a minimum of violence, a minimum of sin, then we can live peacefully in this world. We don't have to work too hard, and we don't have to suffer. And that is a sattvic mode of existence. But the condition is detachment. We're a little detached from everything. So that's the sacrifice and mode of passion. They'll say, well, these people in sattva-guna are useless. They can't enjoy in the material world. They're completely detached from everything. But they are peaceful. And the people in the mode of passion and ignorance, yes, they're very attached to enjoying and very subject to the polarities of happiness and distress. So that is the difference. So here Akura is telling Dhritarashtra that you have to be very careful how you act. You may consider your sons, I have to do this because of my sons, or I have to do this because of whatever reason. But ultimately, when it comes time, you have to be responsible for whatever actions and decisions you made, and there may be suffering involved in that. And you cannot say, well, it's because of my sons or because the Pandavas did this or whatever. No, it's because of your action. And that's the sense that says you are alone. Every creature is born and dies alone. We experience the results of our actions accordingly. Good actions good lead to enjoyment. And sinful actions lead to suffering. And we cannot avoid that. So we cannot blame other people. So it is due to those karmas that we're born in the material world, and we have no choice where we're born, how we're born, mother and father, country. We have no choice in the matter at all. It is decided, but it is also not decided by anybody else at the same time. It's decided by the laws, but the laws are decided by the karmas we did, and the karmas are decided by the actions we did. So ultimately, we are responsible for our position in this material world. We are ultimately responsible for where we are born and what we, what position, what father and mother, what country we're in. Ultimately, as a result of all of our previous actions. So we cannot blame other persons for all that. So this is, in other words, karma is a result of our actions, and these actions and reactions and the suffering and enjoyment of the material world are ultimately our responsibility, not God's and not anyone else's. If we don't blame God, then the other logic is we'll blame, if we don't blame other people, we'll blame God. Well, God made a bad lot of karma and he's unjustly interfering and giving me some suffering when I didn't do anything. So God is unjust, so we want to blame God. So that is one way of looking at the world, and then we reject God. So we say God doesn't exist, or whatever. And this we get happiness and suffering due to chance operations in this material world. That's one way of looking at the world. And of course it's pretty depressing then. The other way is to be sattvic, and sattvic people are more inclined to accept scriptural conclusion because they have access to higher knowledge, and they have prakasha, appreciation of knowledge. So therefore, they will accept the scriptural idea that there is laws at work, laws made by God, but ultimately the results of the laws are not God's fault or his prejudice, but simply because of our activities themselves. So the law is made by God, but it is a just law. And what we do with the law, breaking the law or doing certain things, this determines the results we get with that law. That is all. So the person in sattvic mode does not blame God at all. He thinks it's a good law. And he follows the law, and therefore he's peaceful. Now, so that is being responsible, just as in a material society, responsible people follow the laws of the government, and they don't commit sinful activities, and they live peacefully, and nobody bothers them. And some people that don't want to follow the laws, and then, of course, they commit crimes, and then they become a trouble to the state, and the state punishes them. And they may complain against the government or whatever, or the laws or whatever. But nobody really cares for that. And those people who are following the law say, no, you commit the crime, therefore you get the punishment. So people in sattvic mode are like that. The laws are okay. They accept the laws. And they accept the rules that are made, and they follow the rules, and they live peacefully. And those in tamaguna and rajaguna don't follow the laws. They're ignorant of the laws, or they reject the laws. And then they suffer as a result. So therefore, one should come to the level of sattva, and one should come to the level of knowledge. At least that far we have to go. and then we can begin to become a little bit disentangled from the material world. Now, so that is sattva. We get up to the sattvic mode. As I said, sattva is also a cause of bondage. We get more and more sattvic lives in this material world. We can go to Svargaloka or whatever. But we still get material bodies as a result of that. So Krishna says in Bhagavad Gita, sattva-gund also is bondage. One becomes attached to that type of happiness and peace in that position. And then one gets body after body in that position. So it's also a bondage of sorts. So ultimately, though Krishna recommends sattva over raja and tama, he ultimately rejects that also and says that ultimately we have to come to the position of bhakti, which is transcendental. So varnashram basically is an attempt to bring us up to sattva-gun. It raises from tama and raja-gun to sattva-gun. So it's working within the gunas of material nature. In that sense, it is good because Krishna says sattva is better than raja and tama, so he's trying to raise everybody up. In that sense, good. But it's not a complete system in itself. So Krishna says that bhakti is actually the perfection. It's beyond the material gunas. So this is what we practice. So there are two systems. One is gradual system. Do varnashram, come up to sattva gun, then do bhakti, then you get out of the material world. The other system is don't do the varnashram system, just do bhakti and get out of the material world. So the choice is there. And Krishna gives both choices in Bhagavad Gita. But then in chapter 12, he says, actually, better just to do the direct process, not the indirect process of going through varnashram and everything, karma again, yoga, bhakti. Just do bhakti. Simpler and quicker. And of course, that's what Vyasadeva also recommends to, Narada Muni recommends to Vyasadeva in the beginning of the Bhagavatam, that actually you've been recommending all this karma yoga process as a process of development for the people in the lower modes, but actually in Kali Yuga it will not be effective and it will never advance to bhakti at all. They'll get stuck because of their material attachments. So therefore, simply recommend bhakti. That's all. So in Kali Yuga, this system of gradual development is not practical. Instead, we concentrate on bhakti yoga only. If we do bhakti yoga, this covers everything. So just as we avoid the bad karmas in sattva-gun, but we don't destroy karmas in one sense because we get good karmas and we get caught in that bondage. What bhakti does, it destroys all karmas, good and bad karmas. They all get destroyed. And then because we have a destruction of all karmas, then we can get out of the material world. So this is actually a preferable process. So in the process of performing bhakti, we destroy the bad karmas, therefore we destroy the suffering of material existence. So this is what the people of sattva-gun do, at least they don't get the suffering. So that is also accomplished by bhakti. But bhakti also destroys the punyas, so we don't have to stay in Svargaloka. And sattva action does not do that. It keeps us bound up. So therefore, bhakti destroys both the punyas and the papa, both types of karmas. So therefore, it's superior. And not in the material modes. It takes us out of the material world completely. So this way, the suffering is gone and even the bondage of sattva-gun is gone. So it's a complete process. Whereas varnashram isn't. It leads you up to sattva-gun only and it doesn't get you out of the material world as such. So therefore, bhakti is a preferable process. Of course, we can say, well, in the varnashram system, we have artha, dharma, kama, and moksha. And moksha gets you out of the system. So therefore, in sattva-gun, if you do sattva-gun enough, you can get moksha. So how do we say then you have to do bhakti to get out of the material world? So the explanation is that actually the varnashram system, even to get artha, dharma, kama, you need a little bhakti. Even in the varnashram, if you reject bhakti completely, it is asurak varnashram. And it's not really a varnashram at all. So in the varnashram system, you also have to worship the Lord. and respect the Lord. But we don't call it bhakti because that bhakti is very little. But it is there. And it's because of that bhakti that the system works. And people can progress upwards and they can get their artha and their dharma and their kama. And then the moksha as well. So jnana is within the system of sattva in the varnashram system. But it is only sattvic, according to 11th canto of Bhagavatam. Krishna says it is only sattvic mode jnana. Atma jnana, understanding you're not the body. You're atma. That is sattva-gun, knowledge. So those who strive for moksha by getting atma jnana, they're only in sattva-gun. So the process of jnana is sattvic. Therefore cannot give you liberation because it's only sattvic. So how does a jnani get liberation? So acharyas explain the only way you can get liberation is by bhakti. Jnana process is not. It is in the gunas. So by itself it cannot. Therefore jnana must be combined with bhakti also, like every other process. Then you can get your liberation. And that's what Krishna says in Bhagavad Gita, you know, Brahma Buddha Sanatma. Then bhakti is also that. Mad bhaktim labhate param. So while you do your jnana, you have a little bhakti. A little bhakti, not much, but mostly jnana. And then when you reach the top of jnana and you're ready for liberation, then you reject all the jnana and what's left? That little bit of bhakti result. So then you have a little pure bhakti there, a little morsel of pure bhakti. And that little pure bhakti will allow you to get your liberation. So it is due to the bhakti that you get the liberation, not to the jnana. So therefore we have moksha as one aspect of varnashram system. So that moksha is caused by bhakti, though it's a little bit of bhakti only. So in this way, this process is not considered so effective in Kali Yuga. It is more effective to do the direct process of bhakti yoga itself, even without the varnashram system. And by doing that, we can get the highest perfection of going beyond sattva and getting to the spiritual world, going beyond mukti even, and ending up with prema. So that is the actual process. So in the material world, yes, we have to worry about karmas and worry about what we do, etc. But higher principle is to act according to bhakti. That is a higher principle still. And whatever is accomplished by discrimination in our acts is also accomplished by bhakti. But bhakti gets more than that. It takes us out of the material world completely to the spiritual world, whereas other processes do not do that. So in this sense, it's much superior. Okay, any question?
Maharaj, through bhakti, what is the mechanism? Because of the surrender to Krishna lotus feet, how we get out of the material
world? How does bhakti allow us to get out of the material world? Well, that means what is this? Why are we in the material world to begin with? So we can say, bondage. We have karmas, and all the karmas keep operating on us, and we have infinite number of karmas acting at any particular point to keep us here. What is the source of karmas? Actions. What is the source of actions? Desires. What is the source of the desires? We want to enjoy.
Yeah.
And what is the cause of that enjoyment? Ignorance. Avidya. We don't know that actually our position should be to serve God. So instead we're trying to get enjoyment for ourselves. So the root cause of that ignorance. And the ignorance means, I do not accept God. I want to enjoy. And that is the cause of all the karmas in the material world and our bondage. And that's why we're in the material world, to enjoy. So the process of bhakti starts with this basic assumption. We reject the material world and the object is to serve Krishna and give enjoyment to him. So that cuts out the root of this avidya and consequently the desires and consequently the acts and consequently the karmas. So this is what cuts up the root of the tree of material existence, bhakti. Because its very basis is, I don't enjoy, I give the enjoyment to Krishna. And therefore, the root of karma is cut out. And if we cut out the root, the tree cannot survive. So therefore the karmas wither away. But of course, it is not an immediate, complete surrender. It is a gradual process. So therefore, gradually the tree dies. The karmas are not immediately annihilated. It is a gradual process because our surrender is also only gradual. In other words, our ignorance is not completely removed, but a little bit of faith, we start with a little faith and we do the bhakti and then we incline a little bit more to Krishna, a little more surrender, and consequently a little more of the karmas get destroyed in that process.
That we get love out of Lord Krishna. We get love. And that love becomes more thickened.
Well, faith means we have some sort of inclination to Krishna, a little bit of liking for Krishna, a little bit of liking. So that gets cultivated into a love for Krishna. But it doesn't happen automatically. We have to do our sadhana and we get mercy. And then that way it increases.
At the time of initiation, said that the spiritual master takes that karma. Mm-hmm. Does he take all or part?
Yeah. Well, if he were to take all the karma, then we'd be liberated, wouldn't we? And then we would have Krishna prema. But automatically, we don't get that. So there's two ways of approaching that problem of what does the guru take on initiation. In the Hari Bhakti Vilas, there it describes that just as the king takes responsibility for his ministers and the husband for the wife, so the teacher for his students takes responsibility. So that reply actually applies to after he makes the agreement, then at that point he's responsible for all their activities. And therefore, if they commit a wrong activity, he has to get the blame also. Just like if the children commit some bad activity, then they'll blame it on the parents. Now, of course, we cannot blame the parents completely. Even the child has some little bit of responsibility, but we can put a lot of the blame on the parents because they're responsible for him, for training him up in his childhood, etc. Or the same with the king. The citizens commit crimes and the king is responsible to some degree. That doesn't mean, of course, that the king gets all the responsibility and then the people are free to do all the crimes they want and say, but it's the king's, he gets all the karmas and we don't get anything. No, they share it, definitely. But there's some aspect of this when the disciples commit the bad activities, then the guru has to get the suffering for that because he's responsible for them. So in that sense, he bears the karmas. That's one way of looking at it. And of course, we do know that in the process of bhakti, we have anarchana vritti taking place all the way through from the beginning of our sadhana all the way up through, up into asakti. There's this anarchana vritti taking place. So that's caused by the process of bhakti itself. So therefore, it doesn't mean that all the karmas have gone at that one point in the beginning. No, they're still there and they're... By our practice, we're gradually reducing them. But of course, what the guru does give is he gives that bhakti, which allows us to destroy the karmas. That's another way of looking at it. The karmas are destroyed because he gives the process of bhakti to us.
It seems unfair that this person also should take the reactions to the disciples.
Well, when the disciple takes initiation, doesn't he make a vow? Yeah. So therefore, the guru has to be careful that he only accepts people who are making serious vows. Yeah. And then that makes some little, some precaution is there. So he cannot simply accept anybody. He has to very carefully inspect that person, see if he's serious about spiritual life and is willing to follow his vows properly, not commit, bad activities.
But Maharaj, the guru doesn't know the heart of the devotee.
Well, as much as possible, we have to see that. We have to inspect. Therefore, yeah, the guru may wait a long time if he wants to. He's a little bit not convinced about that person. He may want to look at him for a few years and see what his activities are and see if he's, you know, what his tendencies are. And usually over time that will manifest. If he only sees him once or twice, then it's a problem. But if he sees him often and over a period of years we see his activities, then we can begin to understand what his nature is.
In my initiation, we have certain goals. So, it's very easily understandable, like, you know, drink and all these kind of things. But there are so many situations where we have to decide ourselves what is spiritual or spiritual master for, at the most. And sometimes it might be a bit confusing because it's not really like clear cut.
Mm-hmm.
So, how do we get the intelligence?
Oh yeah, sometimes we are, and that's common in this world. We meet all sorts of situations where we're a little confused about what is the standard to follow and what is the principle, etc. Everybody has that problem. ISKCON has that problem also in some cases, of what kind of decision we're going to make, yeah, on a certain issue. So it is a little bit difficult. And how are we going to come to a conclusion on that issue very, very properly? So, of course, one thing is that we have a broad spectrum of knowledge to work from, and it makes it a little easier. In other words, our background of all the ingredients that are the factors involved in making the decision, you know, on both sides and for ourselves and for this person or that person, whatever. Okay? If we take all that information into consideration and we get all the information that's available, it makes the decision a little easier. That's one thing. And then, of course, if we have scriptural knowledge, then we have some standards, some general standards from the scripture. But of course we know that everything is not mentioned in scripture, and there will always be particular problems or particular cases that come up. Just even in the case of, like, when they caught Aswatthama, and then the women were saying, don't kill him, and Bhima was saying, kill him. And so you had two sides there of his own devotees arguing, you know, kill him or don't kill him. And what are you supposed to do? And then they'll both raise Shastric points. And Shastra will say that. And even in Bhagavad Gita, in the very beginning, Arjuna says, no, I should not kill my relatives because this. And then Krishna says, no, you have to kill them because of this. And they're both quoting Shastra. So then we may get confused by all of this. What is this superior thing? And in the case of Aswatthama, everyone got a little confused. What is going to happen? And then Krishna gave the indication to Arjuna to cut off his hair like this. So he was killed and not killed simultaneously. And that satisfied everybody. So it does take some intelligence sometimes, and maybe difficult for us. In that case, with all the scriptural knowledge and everything, still having some confusion, and then we have to take shelter of Krishna. And Krishna says, you know, I give you the intelligence by which you come to me. So he gives us the intelligence by which we can make a decision and act in that case. Now, in the material world, we may make mistakes also, even as devotees. We try to minimize the mistakes, but in spite of all of the, you know, precautions we take and consideration, we may make a wrong decision sometime also. So we should not feel too bad about that. Obviously, some things are very serious mistakes, and it's obvious, so that we shouldn't make those mistakes. But other cases we don't know, we make do something that turns out not so good. So that, of course, is simply the material world we have to deal with, and we have to learn from the mistakes that we do make and correct ourselves. So that's not so serious, where we do deliberate and try to understand the situation, make an act, but it turns out it was a mistake after all. Then we cannot. That's not so much censurable, or we don't take the blame so much for that because we tried our best, you know, even though it is a mistake. And then we try to correct it afterwards.
Was there any traces of bhakti in Dhritarashtra at this stage or at a later stage?
Oh, any traces of bhakti? Well, it's hard to say, actually. We see that later on. He did actually improve, but that was only at the end of his life. So we can say at this stage, actually, he, because of association with his evil sons and their attachment, therefore basically whatever good points he may have had got covered up, And he also committed aparadh against Vidura, by not listening to him tolerating when his sons insulted him, and etc., and drove him out of the palace later on, whatever. All this was permitted by Dhritarashtra, so therefore he was also part of the offense. And because of that offense, therefore he ends up in more ignorance. So whatever good qualities he may have had are really covered up by his offenses and his association. But we see that the devotee is so merciful that Vidura came back just to save him. And eventually he did that. He actually did save him. And he had Dhritarashtra leave the palace after the defeat and go to the forest and practice austerities and try to become detached. So he did improve at the very end, but that was mercy of the devotees, we can say, at the very end.
Just on this point, you mentioned that Dhritarashtra committed no offense, but he got the mercy of the devotees. Sometimes we see that non-devotees, materialistic people, they we try as devotees to make them make them in contact with other devotees and get them to become Krishna conscious. But sometimes they may be offensive to devotees, and so like. As in, what's better, not to get, like, just to see and if they're offended, not to get them in contact with the devotees, or still?
People are at the stage of offense. Better that we don't directly preach to them and encourage them in that way, just indirectly through, you know, prasadam or whatnot, and don't do the preaching. That's why it says that don't preach to the faithless people, because then if they commit offense, then it becomes worse. Right. Yeah.